Hello, and welcome to Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. Diabetes Dialogue is a monthly podcast hosted by myself, Dr. Natalie Bellini, and Dr. Diana Isaacs, providing a regular news roundup of the latest clinically applicable insights across diabetes and metabolic diseases, with a focus on leveraging technology to improve diabetes care. Produced by HCP Live Endocrinology, the audio version of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, with a video version available only on hcplive.com.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. I am Diana Isaacs, and I'm here with my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we have another exciting episode at the ATTD conference in Berlin, Germany. So Natalie, who do we have with us today?
It's my honor and pleasure to introduce Dr. Stu Weinzimmer, who is a professor of medicine at Yale New Haven Hospital.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about your true work and what you do at Yale and your pediatrics?
Yeah,
so pediatric endocrinology.
Yeah, I'm a professor of pediatrics. So I take care of the little ones, although they're loath to leave us, so we end up following them into their 20s. Yeah. Diabetes is mostly what I do, and I spent the last 25 years really focusing on diabetes technology. We were among the first to test and evaluate the prototypical closed-loop systems, and now they're, of course, the state-of-the-art and the standard of care. And so this conference is really about just seeing, for me, what's new and exciting, continuing the studies. We've gotten past the first-generation systems in the U.S., and we're now on to second and, dare I say, third-generation systems. One of the projects that we presented at this conference was comparing, was a head-to-head comparison of the first-gen system in the U.S., the Medtronic 670G, with the second-gen Medtronic system, the Advanced Hybrid Closed-Loop System, or 780G. And we specifically focused on postprandial glucose control, because that's really, now that these systems are out and they're working, people are really, what can you do for me now? What's next?
And
so, so the real, I think, active thing for me at this meeting was seeing and listening to all the talks about how can we control meals better, And so my talk kind of went through how the second gen system fares with meals better than first gen systems, and some of the other solutions that we can apply to meal control besides just closed loop. So there's data about using adjunctive medications, some of the GLPs and SGLT2 inhibitors, and even inhaled insulin. Of course, as a pediatric endocrinologist, my standard line is that people don't really want to do more to control their meals, they want to do less to control their meals. And so I thought one of the exciting things was looking at what happens when people don't bolus for meals, and how, not that you're supposed to not bolus for meals, but they don't always bolus. And one of the points that I tried to highlight in my talk, and this is what I think was really exciting about this meeting this year, was that in addition to what's best practices and what people can do to optimally control their blood sugars, I think there's a greater sensitivity this year to what people are actually doing and sort of patient-reported outcomes, what people want for their own diabetes care. So as a person with diabetes, you may not want to do a million different things to have the tightest control. You might want to do the least you can do to have acceptable control. So there was some really great data about not bolusing, or new strategies or new algorithms to optimize people who are not regularly bolusing for meals. And I think that's where these next gen systems are going, and I think I'm really excited about that aspect of practical diabetes management.
Right, because that's really what you see in the office every day.
We both do adults, and we in the real world see,
could you just take some at dinner? Your biggest meal, when you bolus at your biggest meal, let's start there, right? And we are adjusting those AID systems to try to be aggressive enough that they will treat those numbers, and yet if they do bolus, what happens, right? That's where the hard part comes in, because you can't, if they're not going to bolus for meal, they're not going to turn it on or off. they're just going to let it go, right?
Right,
so you have to be careful, but you're right. I think that is the next biggest sort of that task to address. Because if even if you can wake up at 100 or 120 or whatever the number is every day, as soon as you start to eat, you see these big spikes, and 2 hours after every meal is 6 hours a day, and that's 25% of your time. And so now all of a sudden our time in range isn't at the goal. And you know, so if that happens 3 times a day for the average person, now you have a teenager, and they eat 6 times a day, right? So 6 times 2, right, is 12 hours a day. That's 50% of the time there. The blood sugar is high because they're not bolusing.
Right. And you know, in the old days, you know, well, I guess it's still a consideration. People are sometimes asked to perform so they can get an automated insulin delivery system.
Yes.
And I am so not for that. I mean, I think, you know, to withhold, you know, sort of superior technology just because you're not using it 100% correctly or optimally,
right,
you know, I think is a problem, you know. And you see it with adults as well. I mean, we have a saying in pediatrics that, you know, children are not just small adults, but I guess adults aren't just large children. You know, I'm okay with somebody, I mean, I would prefer if they bolused all the time, but I would rather they be on a system that can improve their meal control when they don't bolus than withholding that.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we got into a little bit of a discussion at dinner one night about how is the FDA going to look at these? You know, are they going to approve a system where you don't have to bolus, knowing that you're not going to get the optimal postprandial control? And I don't know. I don't know if the FDA will. I know how they'll look at that. But you know, as a clinician, you know, I'm not off after people, and I am.
Right. Yeah. I wonder, because I know there's a lot of work on standardizing the patient-reported outcomes, and so if we can do that and show that it's like less burden, less diabetes distress,
mm-hmm.
I would hope those types of systems could get approved.
Yeah, I mean, they're spending a lot more time with PROs. It's going to be hard to get that through on a regulatory pathway, but, you know, we can always hope. I mean, at one point, the FDA wasn't looking at CGM data, so, you know, the bar moves.
Absolutely. So, did you attend any of the time and titer range discussions?
That was an interesting. We had a meeting on Tuesday, I think it was, and there was a very, very active discussion about the time and tight range, and you know, I think it's the same kind of discussion, right?
Yes.
I mean, there are people, you know, certainly for pregnancy, right? I mean, for pregnancy, I think that's a huge win. I don't know if that's the right word, but it's an important distinction from time and range because of the tighter goals that you need for a healthy pregnancy, but. I worry a little bit about how these nuanced differentials are going to be, you know, pushed out into the larger world of clinicians who take care of diabetes. You know, pediatric endocrinologists, most children are cared for by endocrinologists, not pediatricians. Most adults, particularly those with type 2, are taken care of by internists or family medicine folks or you know, a wide range of clinicians. And I just don't want people to get too confused so that they're not seeing the bigger picture. Like I am all in favor of our type 2 patients or even our non intensively treated type 2 patients to get on CGM, but I don't want some of these potentially confusing messages to keep people from getting these technologies.
Right.
You know what? We presented in the yearbook session just one of the papers out in the last year about how CGM, even in non-intensively treated patients with type 2, can benefit from CGM. You know, not just on glycemic metrics, but on reducing acute costs related to acute diabetes-related events, acute hospitalizations related to diabetes, or even all-cause hospitalizations. And so, you know, this was a big Medicare data dive.
Right.
You know, I think that, and they did do a formal cost-effectiveness analysis on it, but I mean, if you think about any one hospitalization for hypoglycemia is $20,000,
right.
Any DK admissions probably an adult, I don't know, probably $50,000 to $100,000.
Right.
So I think there's potentially some great cost savings there.
It's interesting because Diana and I both live in Ohio, and Ohio Medicaid covers CGM for everyone with diabetes.
Regardless, if they're even on medication, as long as they have a diagnosis.
As long as they have
so you don't
a diagnosis.
Have to be on insulin.
Yeah.
Nothing.
And it's available at the pharmacy now.
So and you send it to the pharmacy.
Okay.
So, yeah. And we all know as grateful as we are, that it has to have been proven to them that this is cost effective. We don't do things with insurance that isn't cost effective, right?
Sure, sure.
So the idea that, and I think someone else said Illinois maybe,
yes,
is another state that is, Grazia Aleppo, who's here, said the same thing in Illinois. And I think we're gonna see that as there is more and more data around this does work and it does prevent big costs, right? So for every single patient, but if it's enough of a big cost savings as a whole, that they're absolutely, you can have one.
Yeah,
right?
And
what an amazing thing.
And I don't know how this will translate into that cost analysis, but
right.
You know, as a clinician, it makes your visits so much more efficient.
Yes.
You can really much more accurately guide your therapies. I mean,
right.
When you're hitting therapeutic failure, I'm going to hate that word, but you're not hitting your therapeutic targets, you know,
right.
That's when you know you need to advance. Or you're trying to motivate somebody to take that dose of insulin
right.
At mealtime. You can see what the glucose levels are doing in between meals. You know, that, you know, and the financial, one of the other articles we presented in the yearbook session was about how Australia, they fully funded CGM for all children with type 1
right.
Up until the age of 21, and since 2017, so this is not new, but the analysis of how children are now doing with that policy change, that came out in the last year, and as you might imagine, the utilization of CGM went from 5% of kids to 80% of kids,
right.
and not surprisingly, the kids who were using CGM statistically significant drops in their A1Cs that persisted
right.
Over 2 years. You know, so that will translate into, you know, we'll see the same thing in adults.
Right, right. That's exactly it.
I'm kind of curious what your experience has been with access of AID system in kids. I mean, we hear all the time that there's disparities, inequities. Kind of, what's been your experience? Have you seen any efforts to kind of bridge the gap?
Yeah, luckily in the state of Connecticut where I practice, I haven't seen too many barriers to from an access point of view to getting on AID. The data are clear that there are disparities. And there's a multitude of reasons for that. I mean, there's financial reasons for that. There's sadly non-financial reasons for that as well. I mean, we conducted a qualitative study a year or two ago, and it was really probing kids about their experiences or thoughts about technology, and we specifically zeroed in on Black adolescents who have been shown to be sort of lower adopters for a multitude of reasons, as we mentioned. And one of the issues that they brought up, I mean, the things that you might imagine, that we didn't know if we could afford it, we didn't know if our insurance could. And as it turns out, that's actually not a problem. It's a perceived problem. That's not as big a problem, but there's a problem with representation. You know, people often told us, I don't see people like me using these devices. And I thought that was a huge tragedy. It really is sad. And actually, we now have some funding from the NIH. I'm partnering with one of the professors at the School of Nursing, and we're developing a peer mentoring intervention for kids to sort of introduce technology in a way that, you know, sort of fosters representation. So
right.
we're developing an intervention where we're going to basically train the trainer. They're not going to, you know, these are going to be young adults who successfully use technology who are either Black or Latinx, and just meet with kids who are thinking about it and get them to, you know, give them the skinny on what were the barriers and what were the benefits. And this project is just launching, so I don't have any data
okay.
on that now, but hopefully next year.
That sounds great.
Yeah,
that does.
Yeah,
it sounds
no,
like
it's
such a good.
It's
what a great idea, too.
And, you know, just even the beginning of having these conversations, you know, you learn so much. You know, I have one young man who's been my, you know, I've taken care of him for years, and he's since moved on to adult care, but he's one of our stakeholders, so he's helping us develop the intervention. And he, you know, he said, I was the only kid that I had ever seen who was Black with diabetes, and he was like, oh, I stood out enough in my school, and now I'm wearing something that makes me stand out even more. And
right.
it's like this intersectionality of difference. And so these are the kind of things we really need to sort of dig into.
Yeah.
And I think that it will benefit when we can cross these levels.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So we'll see where it goes. I mean, again, it's early, but we have high hopes for it.
Right. Wow.
That's awesome.
Wow.
Yeah.
So anything else that was like sparked your interest that highlights from this conference?
You know, the best part of the conference for me is just to see the passion of all the people who were really involved in it. And every year the conference gets bigger and bigger, which is, yeah, you know, which is a lot of fun. I mean, I've been coming to a number of these for, I think, 15 years now, and it started off as a pretty small niche field, but, you know, 15 years, as I've gotten older, 15 years doesn't seem like a whole long time, but just where the... how quickly things have moved, it's just so fascinating. And I'm really excited to see, you know, just the diffusion of technology into increasing greater populations, as you say, people with type 2, people with cystic fibrosis, and these are just gonna, help everybody. You know, it used to be much more about type 1, and it's not now. That's just so important. Well, the things we've learned can apply to such a larger population.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think someone was saying there's like 4,000 people here. And I was like, really? I was like, it feels small. Like, I feel like I know people and I keep seeing people. And she's like, that's because you're meeting more people in this space. Like, so it's really, like, it's so great. Yeah, encourage more people to
come. Yeah, it's a great meeting.
Right, cool. Well, thank you so much for
my
joining
pleasure.
Us.
My
so, thank you. So informative. And have a great rest of the meeting.
Thanks.
Thank you.